This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me today is Will. And we are continuing in our series in Genesis, going through the life of Abraham. And so today we're going to be in chapter 16. And this is one that is both beautiful, challenging. There's all kinds of elements of this chapter that make you go, hey, wait a minute, I don't like this. You know, and we find that the scripture is filled with that. For the life of Abraham, like we've talked about this before, but just to kind of recap where we've come from, Abraham and Sarah are approached when they're in the land of Haran. And God comes to Abraham and he says, I want you to leave everything that you know here, your father's household, everything else. And I want you to come and I'm going to give you a nation. I'm going to give you a great nation. I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. And by the way, through you, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. So if you're Abraham and Sarah, the promises for you, you're thinking, oh my goodness, this is such a relief because I've been, if you're Sarah, I've been barren for 65 years of my life, unable to have children. Now God has come to us. He's going to take away the shame that we have felt our whole life in this place that worships fertility gods and everything else. I'm finally loved. I have a God who finally sees me. He calls me off. He takes them into the promised land. And you're expecting, like, if you human expectation is this is going to go quickly.
Yeah, magic wand effect.
Yeah, that's right. Like, she's going to be pregnant on the way just because she obeyed, and that doesn't happen. In fact, more than a decade goes by, and there's nothing.
Silence, even.
Right? So if you're 65, you're already lived a life of barrenness, plus now you're postmenopausal. So every year beyond that just gets more and more absurd.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and the natural, it just becomes more and more ridiculous. And so by the time you get to today's passage, you find Abraham, whose faith has been again and again wavering, right? Yeah. Back and forth. You know, he's giving Sarah to Pharaoh's harem in chapter 12 and putting the whole promise at risk. Then, you know, you have him where he's like, I have nobody to give my estate to except Eliezer. Like, you can tell he's actively thinking, I may not have someone to give my stuff to. I'm struggling with the promise. He keeps trusting God. He keeps following God. But you can tell up here, all the doubts are there. And the same is true for Sarah, his wife. And that's going to be a big deal for today's passage. And the theme that we've run through in Genesis 12, 13, 14, and 15 is Abraham is a lot of these, right? A lot of peaks where you're like, man, this guy's amazing. A lot of valleys where you're like, is he saved? Like,
yeah, let's get a new guy. Let's start a new one.
Right. Like, you really do. He's hard to like sometimes. Today, he'll be hard to like again. But what's the one consistent that we've been building here?
The promise is real.
The promise is real. And God is the only character in this story who's faithful. Mm-hmm. He stays true to his promise, despite the fact that Abraham is a total, you know, mental case sometimes and doubting things, which is, by the way, in the flesh, totally understandable. If I was him, I would have doubted every bit as much, probably more and worse. And yet God is like, I'm not done with you. I'm coming after you. Same thing is going to be true with Sarah. And the same thing is going to be true even with Hagar, who comes into their household. And she is going to kind of take center stage today.
Yeah, and today's passage is going to be an extreme human example of trying to solve the promise yourself.
Yeah.
It's going to be extreme. It's going to be shocking. There's going to be parts that are gross and that we don't like. But it's very human of this chapter to be like, all right, I've waited God long enough, and I'm going to make this happen myself. Mm-hmm. Which we all get to at some point a lot of the time.
That's right. And this is also one of those chapters where you kind of have to remove your brain from modern day and allow yourself to experience what they're experiencing in the cultural context in which they live.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be dealing with slaves. We're going to be dealing with the way that a patriarchal culture that treated women really badly. We're going to be dealing with a lot of that kind of stuff. But this is the culture in which they lived. It would not have seemed at all out of the ordinary for them. And so, like, let's jump into the story. And as we go, we'll give some of the historical, you know, perspectives and things like that. But it says, now Sarah, so the camera, if it's been focused on Abraham throughout the whole journey, now all of a sudden the camera shifts over and you see Sarah. And it's like we've said, what is she feeling?
She has.
Like, this is not happening. Like, God keeps coming to you, Abraham, but he hasn't come to assure me of anything. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe the promise was meant for you and someone else, like, because I'm getting older, like, I'm way beyond childbearing years. Maybe I'm the problem. Maybe God loves you. Maybe the promise is for you, but, you know, he's not coming directly to me, so maybe I'm the problem. Maybe I'm the reason why God's blessing isn't coming out. Maybe I need to remove myself. That's where her mindset is.
Because she hasn't heard from God at all.
Yeah.
So all this whole time it's been God to Abraham and somehow Abraham to Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Which shows you another failure of Abraham. Because in the Bible, the man is lifted up to be the head of the household, right? Mm-hmm. They're co-equal in dignity, but the man is the one who's held accountable for the household. So as a priest of his home, where's Abraham's failure in this? It's like he's got a wife who's been for more than a decade feeling like, I'm not sure it's for me. I'm not sure it's for me. And it's going to culminate in today's chapter.
And so, he's done stuff that make her feel like giving me to Pharaoh doesn't feel like, hey, you're worried about me.
Yeah, that's correct. And so you've got a husband who has failed to cultivate his wife's heart to be like, no. Hey, remember in Genesis 15 when I believed God and God was like, you know, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to stars in the sky. That's for us, babe. Like, yeah. I don't want you to despair. Come on in. This promise is for us. And by the way, I'm not going anywhere until God carries out this promise for us. If it's not going to be with us, it's not going to be at all. So that sense of loyalty, of really bringing her into the promise, mm-hmm. is absent, and it creates tons of insecurity for her.
Yeah.
So again, we're beating up on Abraham, but this is kind of where the story leads you. Like, why is your wife having these doubts to where she feels like she's not a part of this? Mm-hmm. And when she comes to him with a pretty ridiculous solution in this chapter of, oh, sleep with my maidservant, what's his response? All right.
Okay.
Yeah, like, there's no. What do you mean? Like, God is for us. God is going to make good on his promise. Like, do you not see how much he loves us and how much he cares for us and how he has, you know, been on our side and redeemed us through all these messes? Like, Sarah, he loves you. Like, just be patient.
Yeah.
Trust in the promise. He doesn't do that. Mm. He allows her to drift and wonder if she's the problem. And that might be unfair, but that's the way that I see this. I don't know how else to read it.
Yeah.
So verse 1, now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. Now, we pause here. Where does this female Egyptian, makes it a point to tell you that, female Egyptian servant, where does she come from?
I mean, most likely when Pharaoh kicked him out of Egypt. Like, here, I want you guys out of here so fast, take all of this stuff.
Yeah, so when Abraham in chapter 12 gets to the land and it's in famine, and he's like, oh, I don't trust God, you know, I don't trust God in the land, I'm going down to Egypt, Pharaoh will feed me. He goes down there, and then he tells his wife, go into Pharaoh's harem, pretend like you're my sister, otherwise they may kill me. He trades her out, and it says that Pharaoh rewards him with camels and donkeys and all these animals, but in addition to that, he also gets manservants and maid servants in Egypt. So why does he have Hagar? Why do they have Hagar? Because Abraham went down to Egypt and traded his wife to begin with. So what is Hagar a reminder of already?
The disobedience, the shame, everything that comes with that.
Yeah. I remember when my husband cast me away to Pharaoh and then got rewarded with this woman. And so now she's coming, and she's got this female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar that they got when they were in Egypt. And Sarah said to Abram something that, like, in our day and age, it's like, what? Like, how in the world? Sarah said to Abram, behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children.
And that's big, because that's not just God hasn't given me a child. That's the God is actively stopping me from having children.
There you hear Sarah's heart. And can you relate to that? Like,
yeah. I mean, it's true. God has if God isn't giving her children, he is preventing her from having children.
Yeah, so it's on him. He's sovereign, right? He made the promise, and he's chosen not yet to follow through with it. Which, on this side of reading this, we know, like, he's building faith in them. He's building his relationship with them. He's teaching them to trust in his promise, even when it makes no sense. But for her, in the middle of this, in the waiting, it's like, he's prevented me. Yeah. Like, I'm the problem here. Like, for whatever reason, the Lord chose to stop up my womb. Like, he's not giving me children. I'm the problem. So what does she say? Go into my servant, Hagar. It may be that I shall obtain children by her. In other words, I'm the problem.
Yeah.
You know, this God, in some sense, is no better than the God Nana that we left back in, you know, who couldn't fix my fertility issues either. So let's scheme.
Yeah.
If this is going to happen, it's going to happen by our own scheming. We got to figure this out. It's going to be by our efforts because, you know what, like, it doesn't seem like this God can overcome impossible circumstances either.
Yes.
Have you ever been there? Like, have you ever thought, you know, here are promises that God has directly given to you or salvation, and you get to a place where the circumstances in your life seem so overwhelming that you're like, God, like, do you have it in for me? Like, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I'm not really his because I can't make sense of how much pain is in these circumstances and for God to still be true to his promises. You ever have those doubts creep in?
Yeah, probably. I mean, definitely more than I should, and much more minor scenarios than this, but that is one of the temptations to turn to quickly. Mm-hmm. Like when my life just doesn't add up like I want it to, like I planned it to, it's all of a sudden like my fingers point at God, like, hey, God, what are you doing to me?
Yeah.
Why are you allowing this? Why is this happening? Why aren't you taking this away? Why aren't you doing, it's a lot of like why, whys. The onus is on you.
Yeah. And the quick conclusion is either he's cruel, which is not true, or I'm just not part of this covenant. Like maybe I'm not his. And that's also not true in this case. But you can tell Sarah is despairing here. And by the way, we can learn a lot from Sarah because in the next couple of chapters, you're going to see that God is very, very intentionally focused on her and is going to come to her and reaffirm and reassure her in a couple of chapters from now. But right now, and all the wondering and the husband's failure to bring her along into the promise and to give her all the assurances, she's floundering here, understandably. Like, yeah, she's in a lot of pain, and you're going to see a side of her that's kind of yucky. So I want to cast her as a sympathetic figure at the beginning of this.
Yeah, you can imagine the comparison game she's playing. I mean, all her life, everyone around her is producing children. Mm-hmm. She feels like the outcast. She feels isolated. And now, I mean, even worse, now Hagar's going to have a kid quickly. So she's going to look at Abraham like, wasn't your fault. Obviously, it's still my fault. Mm-hmm. Even more so now that you've proven yourself in this regard.
Yeah, that's not going to feel
good. It just keeps on getting worse and worse for her.
Yeah. And so here's the shocking part of this. Again, we're looking to Abraham, the man of faith, right? Like, and she says, you know what? Like, God has come to me and he has stepped in and he's not allowing me to have children. In other words, I'm questioning the promise as my part of it. Go into my servant that it may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abraham validates that fear.
Yeah.
Right? He doesn't say, no, this promise is for you. Like, of course it is. Which shows you that Abraham secretly is wondering, like, maybe it is her.
Yeah.
Let's give it a shot. It says, Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah. And you're like, hold it. Like, what? I'm trying to imagine.
He doesn't even argue at all. Like, he doesn't even try anything. It's not even like, he doesn't even feign, like, oh, should we? He's like, all right, let's go.
No, but I would never, honey. Like, he listened to the voice of Sarah. And so after Abram lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, notice the language, you brought this up before, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And so, like, whenever you see that language, you know a big sin is about to come. took and gave. It's, you know, Eve takes from the tree in the Garden of Eden and then gives, like, hey, share in my sin. And that language is always interesting. But what I want to point out, and this is where you get into the cultural stuff. Is God okay with polygamy?
No.
Every time it's tried in the Bible, it ends up blowing up. It's not good. The relationship's sour. The wives hate one another. Like, everything goes wrong. And God is very, very expressly saying polygamy is a bad thing by the examples that he gives. And yet, it was common in that season of the world. And, like, try to imagine this. If you got in a time machine, let's say you're a dad with four daughters. Ugh. You get in a time machine, and you go back to the ancient world, and it's like, there's no grocery stores. There's no irrigation. Yeah. There's no plumbing systems. There's no all the things that we take for granted and can figure it out. I'll figure out how to get food, make food. You go 4,000 years ago, which is when Abraham is, and it's like survivalist kind of mentality. Like, if you own land, you better hope it's fertile. You better hope it rains. You better hope that your cattle survives and everything else. But if you show up and you don't have means and you don't have land, or your land is in famine, what does it mean for your whole family?
I mean, death.
You're going to die. And so in that ancient world, if you had a really wealthy person who owned a lot of land and fertile land and had big crops and had huge herds, what did you want? What did you want for your daughters?
To marry that son.
Marry that guy. And by the way, if he has 14 wives, I hope there's some of them, because otherwise it means starvation and death. And so, by the way, I'm not saying that from a moral perspective. Like, don't do that. But from a purely flesh, like, I want my kids to survive. And if it means that all of them have to go with the one wealthy guy as opposed to, you know, marrying Juniper over here. Who's
Juniper? That's not what I anticipated.
who's going to die next month? Like, so that's why polygamy was such a big deal. The wealthy, the powerful took on many wives. And it was actually seen as noble, like a merciful thing to do. Like, I will spread my compassion and my ability to care for others over more and more people. And that was actually a thing.
I just can't wait for the polygamy clips to come out of this.
Oh, gosh.
Without the caveat. Here's, this is ancient times.
Here he is, endorsing polygamy.
Look at him go.
No, don't do polygamy. It's definitely one man, one woman. But if you're living, where does Abraham come from? Where was he born? Do you remember the name of the city? Very good. Very good. You are So one of the oldest legal codes that we have from the ancient world is called the Ur-Nammu Law Code, and it comes from Ur. So we know what their culture would have been like when they were growing up. Like, we know what the social norms and everything else was. And so the Ur-Nammu Law Code allowed a husband to conceive a child with a slave or a concubine to produce an heir if the man's wife was incapable of producing an heir. So, like, when they're growing up, it's like, okay.
Oh, so they're just following a playbook.
This is totally following the playbook.
It's not even a...
Like, and the rights of slaves with regard to children were different, too. Here's number five of the Ur-Nammu Law Code. If a slave marries a free person or a citizen, she is to hand the firstborn son over to her owner. So now, what is it that Sarah says here? He says, you sleep with my maidservant, and when she gets pregnant, whose son is it going to be?
Hers.
Mine, right? Well, that's Ur-Nammu Law Code number five. Remember, we don't have the Ten Commandments yet. Moses hasn't come along. All the Levitical law and everything else is not there yet. So they're walking by cultural conventions and what they notice of the character of God. Here's the Code of Hammurabi. So this is also 3,500 years ago, roughly. Number 146 of the Code of Hammurabi, just so enter into the cultural day, says, if a man takes a wife and she gives this man a maidservant as a child bearer, and the maidservant does bear him children, then this maid assumes equality with the wife because she has borne him children. So now...
Kind of something in for Hagar now, all of a sudden.
That's right. If you... Let's say I'm a slave owner of a woman. Well, here's another great clip to pull out. If I'm a slave owner of a woman in the ancient world, and she goes and marries a free person and they have a kid, I'm entitled to that kid. But if I marry my slave, right, and we have children, now she's elevated to equality with a wife. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So now,
I mean, as much as it can in my modern mind.
It's modern craziness. But here you have Sarah, who's like, I'm not going to have kids, but now if she has a kid, the promise goes on, maybe I would have claim as primary wife to raise this kid, but she then is going to have equality with Abraham. And so now I'm sharing my husband with someone who would have full rights as a wife if she bears children. That's the culture of the day.
I mean, it's kind of dramatic when you think about it.
It is. Like, it's wild.
Real, I mean, a lot of entanglement going on here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things to deal with. I mean, a huge decision for Sarah to make. I mean, because she knows all that. This is not just like, oh, maybe it'll all work out better. It's like, no, this is like kind of a last-ditch effort. Mm-hmm. Like, she thinks she's at the end of this to where, like, I have to do this. There's no other way.
Yeah.
This is all I got.
Yeah, I'm tired of waiting. Yes. You know, this whole thing started, this promise came when I was 65. Now I'm 75. My husband's a decade older than me. Like, this is just getting laughable. And God does not seem to be showing up, right?
Yes.
So there's this tradition you find elsewhere in the Bible. So when Jacob takes wives, right, he intends to marry Rachel, ends up marrying Leah and Rachel, and then they start, like in chapter 30, they start having like this battle of who can have the most children, right? So Rachel's got a maidservant. Leah's got a maidservant. So they're like, oh, you get in there. Like, let's start having kids. And so Jacob is having kids with Leah, her servant, Rachel eventually, her servant. But I want you to listen to one of the ancient customs that you find at the beginning of Genesis 30. Weird again. Weird. But listen to this. It says, so Jacob, Rachel's like, you know, God is not giving me children. She's really upset. Jacob's like, what do you want me to do about it? Like, I'm not God. I can't help this. And so what does Rachel do? She says, here's my maidservant, Bilhah. Go into her. So there it is again. And she will bear a child on my knees that I may have children by her. So that's a weird ancient custom. So now she will have children on my knees. Well, how do you imagine that?
Honestly, I have no idea.
So here you go. The one who wants to have children, who is the wife,
okay,
would take the maidservant, and the maidservant giving birth would sit at the end of her knees, right?
Okay.
It's like almost like on your lap, but at the end of your knees, so that when Bilhah gives birth, she's in the posture, the wife is in the posture as though she's sharing in the childbirth.
Huh.
And so they would do this together. Kind of crazy. Again, ancient world's a wild place. It's a really wild place. But that's what Sarah's going for. That same kind of custom that's going to show up in Rachel, who's her granddaughter-in-law, she's going for. Like, this is going to be our child, but it doesn't work out that way.
And just hard in modern times to, I mean, we live in a world where children aren't as desirable, it seems.
Mm-mm.
Like, these people are going through anything just to have a child, which part of it's survival, but, you know, part of it seems that, like, they just care more. So it's kind of honestly hard to imagine. Like, most people in modern day, in 2025, would be like, all right, well, we don't have a kid. That's okay.
Yeah.
Whereas these people are desperate for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, barrenness is super painful to people who genuinely want to have children.
Yeah.
But you look at the number of people who deliberately insist on not having children. That would have been unthinkable in the ancient world.
Yeah.
Absolutely unthinkable. No one to carry on your name. It was a shame to your society. Like, you wanted to have kids to make the city healthier. You wanted to have kids to grow the army. You wanted to have kids to help you grow your wealth and your property and everything else. You wanted to have kids to carry on your name and your legacy so that you weren't forgotten. I mean, it was in a sense, it was a way of achieving kind of an eternal significance in the world.
Yeah,
like your name just didn't go, you know, and there's no one to carry it on. Like that, it was super, super important. The pressures to have, and by the way, for a wife having children in the ancient world, tremendously essential. Because what happens when okay, I'm married to, you know, I'm a woman and I'm married to Bill over here. Mm-hmm. When he dies, guess what happens? In the ancient world, guess how many property rights and legal rights a woman has in the ancient world?
Zero.
None. So if you don't have children to take care of you and to take the land and to cultivate it and to keep that legacy going, you're off on your own.
Yes.
I mean, there's books of the Bible that talk about that too. Think Ruth and Naomi, right?
Yes.
Their husbands die. They're reduced to dire straits unless a man comes in and intercedes. That's just the way the ancient world was. I mean, Ruth is 3,000 years ago. Abraham's 4,000 years ago. that's when we're talking about. So this is like life and death kind of stuff in a lot of ways for them. So where does the story go from here? It says, and Abram went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. So now it's like, I'm going to have a child. In some sense, I'm being elevated to some kind of status of equality with you. But now it's like, this is my man, and I really don't like you. You're the competitor. You think you're entitled to this child. This is my child. Polygamy is idiotic.
It goes exactly the way you expect it to go.
100%. Like, this is going to sound weird, but throw another man into my marriage. There would be bloodshed.
I got to go.
Like, every single day there would be bloodshed. This would not go well at all. So trying to imagine, you know, a covenant relationship that is designed for that level of intimacy and affection and fidelity, that you're intentionally throwing another human being in to share and to divert affections. And this is your fireworks every time. And sure enough, in the Bible, that's exactly what you find, fireworks. Like, humanity is not meant for polygamy, and it's obvious.
So you don't want to be in a truffle right now?
Can you imagine how that would go if Morgan brought in another husband?
No, I don't even want to talk about that. Just the idea of that's ludicrous.
Hey, right? It really is.
And that's a good thing. Like, I should feel jealous for my wife. Like, that's the purpose 100%. Of what it is. Like, I should be give me the attention. I'm not sharing it with this dude.
You cannot possibly love somebody in a pure, healthy, fidelity kind of a way and not have jealousy. Like, if Laura came home with a different man and I was like, all right, there's no chance that I love her as a husband. Like, it's the same way that, you know, God refers to himself as a jealous God. That's one of my, I love that. Like, people are like, oh, God's jealous. That's petty.
He's
like,
a bad guy.
Do you know what that means about his affections for you, that he doesn't want to share you with anyone else, that he loves you enough and knows that the safest and best place that you could be is with him, and therefore he insists upon that because he loves you so much. He doesn't want to share you with petty idols and things that are going to destroy you and use you up and leave you empty. Like, he is a jealous God because he loved you. Now, if he said, I don't care if you do all that stuff, Sam, like, he doesn't love me.
Yeah.
He's jealous. And the same is true when you get to male and female relationships. If they're healthy, there is a jealousy. There's a desire to be the only one. And this whole ancient system, while I understand it for survival's sake, and you want to be with the wealthy guy who can take care of them. By the way, you never find polygamy reverse, right? It's never a woman with five husbands. It's always the guy that's got five wives, go figure. But anyway, We're not meant for that. And so she looks with contempt on her mistress. That is not a shock. And so then Sarah said to Abram, she's feeling it, and like, great, you know, now not only have I wiggled my way out of the promise, and now there's actually a child, maybe God's going to use this child, I don't know. Like, but now inside my own home, I've got someone who's competing for your affections, who hates my guts. Now, not only am I out of my homeland that I've left, and I have felt out with God, now I'm being driven out of my own family. And now, Abram, your eyes are for someone else, and she hates me, and now there's another child where I'm feeling more and more removed from this initial, very exciting, beautiful promise that God gave, and I'm really regretting the fact that I asked you to sleep with her.
Yeah, there's instant buyer's remorse for this plan.
Oh, man.
As fast as you could, I mean...
And so everybody in this story has some yucky parts, and here's where Sarah, like, she's lashing out. So Sarah said to Abram, may the wrong done to me be on you, which, if you're Abram, what are you thinking?
You're like, what did I do?
Well,
other than, you know, listen to you, though.
But
like,
exactly.
This was your plan.
Like, right?
From your perspective, Sarah, I've done everything you wanted me to do, and it just didn't work out the way you wanted, and now I'm the bad guy?
Yeah, now it's all on me. So, I mean, some things never change. There you go. So anyway, may the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she'd conceived, she looked on me with contempt. And it's like, what did you expect to happen? Like, did you just expect Hagar to be this emotionless, you know, automaton that just does whatever you say and you treat her like...
She kind of did.
Cattle. But there's a human element to it. Like, you got to think in the ancient world, we have no categories for this. But for a woman to find a respectable, wealthy, patriarchal guy who says, I want to bring you into my wealth, my family, everything else... For Hagar, this would have been almost certainly something that was, for if she got Abraham, this would have been something that would be like, God is going to bring me children. He's going to take care of them. This is going to be a good deal. Like, it's not, marriage is not the romantic, you know, mushy love relation like we think of today. It's not like Hagar's going, oh, I can't wait till Abram asks me to dance. Like, that's not the way it works. It was life circumstances back then. Yeah. It was arranged marriages, by the way. So it's like the idea that you're like, oh, I wonder if he's going to ask me out. Like, that's not the world this is. It's all arranged marriages, and it's all for benefit of the family and survival. That's what we're working with here.
And you have to think, like, how has Hagar's life gone so far? I mean, somehow she found herself as a slave to Pharaoh. You don't know how that happened. We don't know any of that backstory. But then all of a sudden... You're thinking, okay, I'm Pharaoh's slave, and now all of a sudden I'm being handed this guy just because Pharaoh wants to get him out of here. Now all of a sudden I'm with a group of people I've never seen before. I'm going to a land that I've never been before. Mm-hmm. Just how terrifying that would be. Like, who knows about languages and all that kind of thing. And all of a sudden this woman now is being handed over to have children with him. Mm-hmm. And you just have to think, well, Hagar's just... kind of going through a lot.
Yeah. I mean, every part of her life, the only things that you know about her is that she's mistreated. Yes. She's exploited by other people for their own gain. That has been her life as a slave, as a servant, even as a concubine or a wife to Abraham. Everything is what you can give to me. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody's been concerned about Hagar up until this point. Like, she's a tragic figure in this. Sarah's a tragic figure in this. Abraham is kind of a tragic figure in this, you know, a knucklehead, but he's a tragic figure. Like, everybody you can relate to, you can sympathize with, and then you can turn around and be like, oh, gross. Like, no, don't do that either.
Yeah, it's very human. Like, we all have things that are like, man, things just aren't going our way. And then we have things where we step on it ourselves, and it's like, mm-hmm. All right, I get that.
Yeah. So she's now throwing contempt on Sarah. So there's a lack of grace and mercy toward her. Sarah's then throwing it on Abram, like, you deserve all this. Like, why am I getting hatred when you deserve this? And the moment that she conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me. And so now she's like bringing down, you know, God, I want you to declare a winner because right now we're fighting. And all of this is painting a picture of what happens when you try to do things in your own strength.
Yes.
Like, if Abraham and Sarah had said, you know what, God said this, and he promised it to us, and so we're going to bind together, and I'm going to love you, and my fidelity is going to be to you the same way God's fidelity is to me, and we're going to do this together, this would have had a much less painful twists and turns all throughout it, right? But what do they do? What are both of them guilty of doing?
Try and do it on their own.
I'm going to do it on my own. Like, God's promise isn't good enough. His work's not good enough. I'm going to add to it. I'm going to, you know what, if I do this and I do that and I do this, then I can kind of force the promise and I'll bring it about. And this is something that the New Testament talks about. It actually uses an allegory about Sarah and Hagar in Galatians chapter 4, starting at verse 21. Let me just read to you how Paul, the Apostle Paul, read this. He says, tell me, you who desire to be under the law. What does that mean? Like, those of you who think you can be good enough by following and keeping all the rules and earning your salvation and doing it outside of God, right? Like Abraham and Sarah, when they decided to do it their own way, that didn't go well. But for those of you who desire to be under the law, to earn your salvation by keeping all of it, do you not listen to the law? For it's written that Abraham had two sons. And you're like, whoa, where did that come from? One by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh. That means according to, I'm going to earn it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to, you know, God said this, but yeah, he's probably not going to carry it. I need to help him out. One was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. And then he says this. Now, this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two different covenants.
Yeah.
Well, that's weird. Like, this is an interpretation that's interesting. One's from Mount Sinai. What happens at Mount Sinai?
Ten Commandments, law.
The law. You be good enough. Earn your blessing, right? Bearing children for slavery. That's Hagar. Now, Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she isn't, which is all legalism and self-righteous Pharisees and everything else. For she is in slavery with her children, but the Jerusalem above is free. She is our mother. And so what Paul is doing is he's saying this is a perfect picture of legalism versus grace, right? God came to Abraham and Sarah and said, I'm going to bring about salvation through you, period. I'm going to do it. And then they had to say, he's not moving fast enough. He's not moving on our timetable. I'm not sure I feel all the feels of God doing stuff. So I better intervene and I better start adding to his story and doing things my way. And that's what legalism calls you to do. You better be good enough. You better slave away. You better earn it. You better chip in to what God has already accomplished. And what happens? It creates strife. It creates a sense of slavery. It creates conflict. It creates all kinds of mess that comes out of it, as opposed to if you'd have just trusted in the grace of God's goodness and his promise, none of that would have happened. So when you go out striving for your own salvation, it's like you're taking the Ten Commandments and you're taking Sinai and the pressures of doing everything correctly and all the self-righteous legalism that the Pharisees and the religious leaders of Jesus' day are throwing on everybody and saying, yeah, I'd like more of that. That's where I want my hope of salvation to be. Give me more requirements that I can never measure up to. And it's like, why would you do that? Stop. Trust God's promise. Stop trying to scheme. Your mother is the heavenly Jerusalem. It's free, and it comes entirely by God's promise, and he does it all. Just receive it. Be at peace. Be free. And that's where Paul looks at this story that we're walking through today and says, that's true.
Yes.
Abraham and Sarah are chasing after legalism and thinking, oh, I don't know what God thinks about me. I don't know if I'm still his. I don't know if I'm, so I better do something about it. No, that doesn't end well. Stop. Be at peace. Trust him, right?
Yeah, that's a good reminder, because when you expound it like that, it's obvious. Like, I don't want that life. But then in the day-to-day, it's so easy to just be like, I got to figure this out. I got to be a better dad. I got to be a better husband. I got to be a better worker, because it all relies on me. There's just such a self-focus and the sin of all of our hearts that, man, just the freedom of saying, I don't have to have this all figured out right now, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
To let yourself off the hook a little bit.
You know, there's an interesting thing in Paul's epistles, because his writings are so against legalism. Yeah. You know, it's very heavy on the focus on grace. But one of my favorites, I think it's 2 Corinthians 3:18, I think. I just did this not long ago, so I think that's right. But it's where he's talking about how your future is, you're just changing from one degree of glory to another. And that starts now, but it will continue for all of eternity. You're a finite creature, but even in heaven, beyond this life, you're always going to be growing more and more into the image of Jesus. You're going to be enjoying more of his capacities and more of his attributes, more of his love and his peace and his joy and all that stuff. So you're always growing more like him, right? And as it's describing this, that you're always, you know, from one degree of glory to another, the only action that it gives you to make that come true is beholding. Like, it's kind of wild. Like, because you're thinking like, okay, well, I need to do this and I need to do this and I need to do this and I need to do this. And what Paul is coming at us with is saying, yeah, you're going to do that if you're a Christian. If you're falling in love with Jesus, your behaviors do change. Yeah. You want to please him, right?
There's obedience.
But it doesn't come from that sense of slavery where it's like, oh, I got to do this to please God. Otherwise, I'll be condemned and I better slave away. Like, no, it comes as a result of you beholding, right? Beholding his glory. And when you see him as he is and you see how beautiful he is, he becomes your ultimate and it draws your heart to want to be more like him. Like, when Abraham sees how faithful God is, and kind and compassionate to all these people, guess what it does to Abraham in time? He becomes more faithful in time. He becomes more compassionate in time because he's seeing God do it and he finds it beautiful. Like that's the way we roll. It's the, I've mentioned this before, but it's like kids who watch a superhero movie. The moment Spider-Man's over, what are they doing?
Running around,
right? Or back in the day watching Superman, you put the cape on and you're pretending to be Superman.
Jumping off things.
Why is that? You become what you worship, right? Yes. And so the key to becoming more godly is not, oh, I got to do more stuff. That'll feel like slavery. You'll hate it. Religion will become oppressive to you. But if you see God for how beautiful he is and him saying, like, come be like me, but I'm going to love you all along the journey of your failures and stumbles. Now, all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute. You're amazing. You're so much better than anything else that I can find in this world. And naturally, slowly, surely, you become more like him. And that's what you find in the patriarchs. That's the whole point of the Abraham story is he's somebody who won't let go of God. He's wrestling with God all along his story through the triumphs and the failures. And by the end of his life, you see, man, he's a different guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a much better husband, a much more faithful man. So, but now he's not yet there. Not in Genesis 16. And so she comes to him and says, oh, I'm really upset. You know, she's hates me. This is all your fault. I want God to judge between us. And Abraham said to Sarah, again, it's like, I'm not going to own anything. I'm not going to be a good priest in the home. I'm not going to be a good leader in the home. He says, behold, your servants and your power, do to her as you please. Which now you're thinking, okay, Abraham, you've just impregnated this woman. And you're not stepping in to try to bring peace between them. You're not stepping in to protect what's right and wrong, to make sure that she's treated okay, to make sure that your wife feels safe and loved. He's just like, okay, whatever. Do to her whatever you want. And you're like, dude, like, come on.
Yeah, the frustration with Abraham in this chapter specifically, and actually a lot of the patriarchs, their sin will fall into it, is they don't try at all. Like zero. It's not, there's no effort going. He's so passive in all of these scenarios that you're just like, man, at least try a little bit. Don't just say, okay, I know this is my responsibility, but you go handle it. I'm just going to be here again.
Yeah. And this might not be a popular take for people that are, you know, hardcore feminists, but what do you notice? Like at the fall, it's the man failing to lead, to protect his wife and to say, no. Like, we're going to fix this. We're going to go to God. We're going to appeal to God. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to stomp the head of the snake before he can bring you into ruin. It's just a passive Adam. And here, what do you find? You find a passive Abraham whose wife is desperate for affection, who's looking for security, who's looking for all that stuff that he has kind of been like, whatever, I'm living my life over here. Can you just, you know, you're probably the reason why we're not having kids. Maybe God doesn't want you involved. I mean, all those, he doesn't like correct immediately and be like, no, like we're in this together. I love you. Like this is going to happen. God is faithful. Instead, he feeds her doubts. And then when you have Hagar, who's another precious soul in this story, he's like, yeah, whatever, do whatever to her. It's just totally passive. And that's not a good place for the head of a household to be. So Abram says to her, behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please. So what does Sarah do?
What she pleased.
She dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. Now, dealing harshly, and I don't know what dealing harshly was, but it's enough to make Hagar and a new kid run off into the wilderness and risk death as opposed to staying with her, right?
And again, you think of it like, even in our world today, one of the most vulnerable humans on the planet is a single homeless mother. And all of a sudden you have to think, okay, that's tough in 2025.
Yeah.
Where there's Publixes, where there's food, where there's
shelters,
where there's those kind of things. Now, Hagar is deciding, okay, I would rather be a single homeless mother in the wilderness where my two options, I guess three options. One is, I'm going to die out there with my kid. The second one is I'm going to come across somebody who happens to be a good person that's going to take me under their care, which is very improbable. Or three, I'm going to come across somebody who's going to treat me just like every other man has treated me, like a piece of property. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be stuck with just a different Abraham or a different Pharaoh or a different person just to run my life. And she says, I'd rather take those three options than stay in this home.
Yeah, it's not good. you going back to the Ur Nammu law code. So this is where they grew up. This is the water they swam in when they were young, right? Listen to rule number 25 of the Ur Nammu law code. And when it says dealt harshly, we don't know what she did, but this is what they did in Ur. Okay. Number 25, if a man's slave woman comparing herself to her mistress speaks insolently to her, her mouth shall be scoured with one quart of salt. So, have you ever had too much salt? Like, just too many sunflower seeds or something?
Yeah.
It gives you headaches. It gives you bad... Like, it doesn't feel good. Your heart races and everything else. A quart of salt, one after the next, of just filling your mouth in and out with salt. It's going to cut your mouth. It's going to dry you out. The idea is it makes it to where your mouth hurts to speak because your tongue is cracked and bleeding and everything else.
Speak insolently.
But then it gives you stomach cramps. It gives you high blood pressure. It gives you dizziness. It gives you vicious diarrhea. It gives you all these things. That was the penalty of what would happen to a slave woman who spoke to a wife insolently.
Hmm.
So if that's the culture she's... So we don't know what Sarah did, but we know it was unpleasant. And we can tell you that in Ur, they did unbelievably cruel things to servants that tried to poach in on the wife. So everything here is just so complicated. And Sarah and her insecurity, that old saying, hurt people, she's just doing things that probably aren't in the character of Sarah. But because she's so wounded by God, so wounded by Abraham, so threatened by Hagar, it's not a good lap.
Yeah, it's not the best looks at any of our characters
today. No. It's like, this is our holy book? Yeah, like, yeah, there's one hero, right? So verse 7, this is I love this. It says, the angel of the Lord, so she flees, runs off into the wilderness, willing to die, willing to take whatever fate comes to her. And who goes chasing?
Not Abraham.
Yeah, right?
Not anybody else.
The angel of the Lord, and who is that?
It's Jesus. Pre-incarnate.
It's God. So like in the burning bush in Exodus 3, how do we know this is God? It's going to be one of the questions. It says, the angel of the Lord appeared into the burning bush. And when it's speaking, when the angel of the Lord is speaking to Abram, and Abram says, what's your name? What does the angel of the Lord say? My name is Yahweh. I am that I am. And so it's like, whoa, this is God. Like the angel of the Lord is God. It's not just an angel dispatched to speak. So this is the pre-incarnate Jesus. This is God, right? He chases after her. And he finds her by a spring of water in the wilderness. She's camping there, probably getting ready for the long journey after this. And it's the spring on the way to Shur. Now, what we know, the road to Shur takes you down toward Egypt. So she's on her way back home. She's going back to Egypt, which is a long journey. Don't know that she would have survived. Would have been really, really hard. And the angel of the Lord chases her down, gets her at this spring, and says, Hagar, say he knows her name. Servant of Sarah, he knows her lot. Where have you come from and where are you going? He knows the answer to the questions. But you ever notice that God always asks the location questions?
Yes.
Where is your brother, Cain? Adam and Eve, where are you? What is he asking? It's not like, oh, I'm curious. I can't find you. I've looked everywhere.
Well, it's just that where we are physically sometimes shows where our heart is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where are you? Like... And so I think what he's saying to her is like, when I came to Abraham, the promise was to him and his household, like including the servants and everybody who blessed him and everything else. And that was the safest place you could have been, Hagar. I don't want you to leave that community. You're one of mine. And he's going to ask her to go back into that, which is like, oh, no, like, what's wrong with this? But here you have the Lord who comes and says, you chase after this. You're going to go back to communities that worship all other gods. You're going to feel forsaken by me. You're going to wonder how this all happened. And I want you to know, Hagar, like, I see you. I know who you are. I know your story. I know where you've come from. I've seen your misery. And I know what you're headed to. And she said, I'm fleeing from my mistress, Sarah. And the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. Let me worry about her heart. Let me work on Sarah. You go back into the community and you're like, how do you feel about that?
Yes.
A lot of people would be like, wait a minute, like he's sending her back there. He knows that's what's going to be best for her. And that's what's going to be best for her future descendants. He's thinking generationally too here. So,
and to trust of, hey, Hager, you're going to have to trust me. I'm going to deal with Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to make sure that happens. Also, this is one of those parts of the Bible where we can't just, like, take this and say to every person who's being abused to go back.
Yeah.
You know, this is descriptive of this scenario. Like, God's handling this one. It's not saying, like, we should all run back to abuse when it happens. No, God, specifically in this instance, knowing the circumstances, mm-hmm. says, Hagar, I want you to go back. I'm God. Trust me. It's going to be for your good. It doesn't make sense right now, but it will.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to be okay with God being God in this scenario.
Yeah. And he's not indifferent to her suffering. It's not like, go suck it up and deal with some more.
And her response is going to be okay, which I feel like we never talk about.
Yeah, I
like,
love
we're always
she's incredible.
We're always on, like, Hagar's behalf, like, how could you send her back, God?
Yeah.
But Hagar's like,
thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is beautiful. Like, she sees it as beautiful. So the angel of the Lord, again, this is the first time, I love this, and I don't know that I said this, but this is the first time that we see the angel of the Lord in all of Scripture.
Yeah, like, you said who would be the first one that Jesus would go and speak to. You
right?
would doubt it's a pregnant Egyptian slave in the wilderness.
But that's exactly who he would chase after, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the fact that this is the first time that the angel of the Lord shows up and it's for this. The first and only time Melchizedek shows up and it's to celebrate Abraham going after and rescuing the people of Sodom and somebody who betrayed him for money. Like, so when God makes these appearances, at least initially, it's always like, whoa, I wouldn't expect it for Hagar. Okay, interesting. But then he comes and he gives her a promise. It says, the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. Then the angel of the Lord also said to her, it's not without its promise. It's not with just saying, go deal with some suffering.
Yeah.
I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. What's that sound like?
I mean, that's the same promise that Abraham got.
That's the same promise that Abraham got. So if you're Hagar, and then you run back and you say, guess what the Lord told me, what do you think Hagar's thinking, and what do you think Abraham and Sarah might be thinking?
That there's more confusion going on.
Yeah. Maybe I'm getting in on the promise to Abraham about the stars and the multiplying, and if you're Sarah and you hear that, and by the way, I think one of the things that's cool when Hagar goes back and says, God spoke to me, now all of a sudden Sarah's got to be like, I probably shouldn't do anything more to you if the Lord has come and announced his favor on you. But now you're sharing in the same promise that Abraham said God said to her, so maybe you too.
Yeah, now Sarah's
have
like,
promise.
Am I still the only one that God hasn't talked to?
Yeah.
I mean, like, now God's talking to my servant.
So if you're Sarah, you're wondering, like, am I out? Has my disobedience, has my lack of faith disqualified me from this? Which we're going to find out is absolutely untrue in the next couple of chapters. So the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you're pregnant, and you're going to bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. The name Ishmael's two Hebrew words, Shema, which is to hear, and El is God. And it means, like, God has heard you.
Yeah, God hears.
God hears, right? And so, he shall be a wild donkey of a man, which all of a sudden you're like, oh man, it was so tender. And now all of a sudden, he will be a wild donkey of a man. And what do we know about that? Do you remember from a couple of years back when we talked about this? What does a wild donkey of a man mean?
I mean, there's a real donkey that's wild.
There like, is a
I didn't
real
know that.
Creature that is called a wild ass. And you have an African and an Asian version of this. And it's referring to a real species. It's not just saying, so he's going to be a donkey and he's going like, to be like wild.
We describe people as wild. Like, hey, yeah, that guy's wild.
Correct. So a wild donkey is a actual species. And what it means is this. He's going to be extraordinarily territorial. He's going to have a huge swath of territory that he does not share with anyone else. Another thing that we know about wild African wild asses is they will absolutely not allow other males to come near their females. Very protective. They protect all the springs and wells, and they get violent and aggressive with anyone that comes in the turf. Now, that's a double-edged thing, because on one end of the spectrum, it's like he's going to have a lot of land.
Yeah.
And he's going to have women that he protects, and he's going to control the springs, and he is going to be very dominant.
He's successful, like, to a certain degree.
Okay, cool. but he's going to be, he's not going to share well. Mm-hmm. He's going to be violent with anybody who comes into his turf. And God kind of spells that out here in the next line when he says his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him. Like he's going to be a territorial guy that doesn't get along well with neighbors, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. And so you see wild donkeys in other places in the scripture. Like this is a common reference. So Jeremiah 14:6, the wild donkeys stand on the bare heights. They pant for air like jackals. Their eyes fail because there's no vegetation. They'll stay out there in these barren desert lands, but they will not leave their land. Like they're loyal to this land. They will not leave it.
And is this where he becomes obviously not the child of promise? Because that description is not the description
correct
that Abraham received. So here it is also like, okay, well, God is saying, okay, this is not the guy.
So when you find later on God is going, I think it's in 21, Genesis 21, like all of the promises that are given to Abraham about Isaac, you know, I'm going to make you a great nation, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to do all these things. All of those promises are ultimately given to Hagar and Ishmael too, except for one. Like we find out Ishmael's going to have 12 princes, just like, you know, down through the line, Jacob's going to have 12 sons, right? They have very similar trajectories, but there's one enormous difference, and that is the promise of salvation, the line of salvation, right? All the nations on earth will be blessed through you, Abraham. That is not Ishmael's promise. That promise goes through Isaac, which then goes through Jacob, which then goes through Judah, on down the line until you get to Jesus. Ishmael's line will not lead to the Savior of the world,
but
he'll be blessed with an incredible nation. He'll be blessed with incredible wealth. He'll have 12 princes that come out of him. And it's almost like a mirror image of what's going to happen with the chosen line, except salvation doesn't come from that line. And Hagar, we see, has faith. Ishmael, I don't get the impression there, but there's a lot of descendants of Ishmael who are Christians who will be in heaven with us.
Yep.
Who else comes from Ishmael, by the way?
Honestly, I have no idea.
Muhammad. So Muhammad traces his lineage back to Ishmael. The Arabs trace their lineage back to Ishmael. So you have a lot of Christians that are Arabs and would be Ishmaelites, but Islam comes through this line, and Islam will emerge in the world through this line. So you have one line that leads to Christianity. That's through the line of Isaac that leads to Jesus. And then the other one leads to Ishmael, will lead to Muhammad and the birth of the death cult of Islam, which has been just not a great thing to have in the world in terms of its worldview implications and the slaveries and oppression that it brings on different people. But it's interesting that this family yields those two monumental figures.
Yeah, chapter 16 has repercussions for us today. You can't just write this off and like, oh, that happened, children were born. It's like, no, there's still things going on today.
Yeah. So at this point, she's hearing these promises, which are only going to grow later on. God's going to give her even more promises. But verse 13, it says, so she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you're a God of seeing. For she said, truly, here I have seen him who looks after me. So notice what's going on there. He comes and says, I want you to call your son Ishmael. And he promises her, I hear you.
Yeah.
Which means what? She's calling on him, which is interesting, right? She's running away. She's not happy, but he hears her, which means she had been praying to him like, God, help. And then when she responds, she says, you're not just a God who hears me. You watched. You saw everything I was going through. You knew my misery. You weren't ignoring me. Your face wasn't turned away. He says, you're a God of seeing, for she said, truly here, I have seen him who looks after me. And that's every time you come across, like, and I love this, women that are in deep distress in scripture, like, you know, you think, Leah, when she names her son, she says, the Lord has looked upon my affliction when she gets pregnant. Hannah says, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me. Like Hagar finally feels seen.
Because she's never been seen before by anyone.
Never been seen before.
I mean, Pharaoh, she's just a piece of property that gets traded. Abraham, she's just a means to an end. And all of a sudden, the God of the universe is like, I'm not going to take anything from you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to give to you.
That's right. And I see your miseries. And I'm watching over you. I got you.
Which is why she can go back to Sarah.
That's 100% the only reason why she would want to go back to Sarah is to know that this God is not blind to all of it. And so, therefore, she called this spring where she was, this well, she called Beer Lahai Roy, which means the well of the living one who cares for me.
Yes.
It lies between Kadesh and Bered, which is way, way south Israel. And Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael, which means that she comes back, tells this story. I met with God. He said to call this son Ishmael. Abram believed her. Abram believed, hey, this is going to be a son who has many, many descendants and you can't be numbered and all these things. And he's like, oh, it's happening. Do you think he thinks this is the chosen son?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think the best of Abraham in this chapter, so yeah, probably.
But he listens to her and it's like, okay, I believe God visited you and I'm going to obey. We're going to call him Ishmael. And Abram's 86 years old. So this is 11 years after first being called. He was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. And so the next chapter, another 13 years go by. No word to Sarah.
Jeez.
Nothing new. She's not pregnant. We don't know what's going on. But we do know that Ishmael is coming up and God is about to give the covenant sign to Ishmael and Abraham, which will be circumcision. That's what we'll talk about next time. So all of this, fascinating. What's the big takeaway that you would take away from this chapter?
I think in our distress, we can be reminded that there's a God who sees us.
I think that's a good one.
I think whenever we feel isolated, like, I mean, that's just a reminder we all need, because I don't naturally come to that conclusion when I'm in a pitiful state, some would say. You know, so this is one of those ones that you need to preach to yourself until you're reminded of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's not like this is in the moment. This is a story that's unfolding for years.
Yeah.
And God sees her, chases after her, hears her prayers, like has a beautiful future for her and her descendants. And like everything is laid out, like he's not abandoning her. And then the other side of this would be the gospel thing. Like when you come to a situation where God has made his promise known to you, but it doesn't seem like he's going to come through. It seems like maybe he's forsaken you. Maybe you're out. Maybe he's changed his mind on you and you're tempted to go run down and figure out how to do things on your own or to strive to make the promise good in your own strength. This is a chapter that says stop.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, if Abraham had just loved his wife, this chapter goes way different, right? If you see your husband or your wife and they're struggling, be an encourager.
Yeah.
Remind them of the promise. Enter into it with them. Like I wished Abram had said in the story, hey, I love you to pieces. This promise is for us and we're in it together. I am not moving. I'm not deviating. I'm yours. You're mine. We're in this together. If God's going to fail, he's going to fail us both. But I don't think he will. He loves us. So let's press on together and keep the faith. He doesn't do that.
No.
Wished he did.
Would have been a shorter chapter.
The good news is we have a bridegroom, a spiritual bridegroom in Jesus, who looks at the worst and the most hopeless, death itself, suffering and everything else. And there's nothing that you could throw in front of him that would make him go, I'm going to back away from this. Like there's no cost he will not pay to protect and redeem his bride. That's the one who loves our souls. That's the one who chases Hagar. That's the one that we put all of our hope in and our trust in. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. Join us next time as we get into the covenant of circumcision, the significance of that, kind of some of the wild expectations that come with that, and the significance that it has for us today. Join us then. God bless.
Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.